Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the web edition of STEM Spots. And with me in the studio today is Dr. Robert Mijanovic, who's a professor of physics and the department head here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Bob.
You're welcome. Good morning, Dave.
Now, Bob, you do all kinds of work. You and I have talked a lot over the years about that sort of thing. And right now you're working on a project involving nuclear materials in some way, shape, or form. Give us the backstory of how you got involved in that.
Well, I've known Dr. Hong Wu Zhu at Los Alamos Laboratory for a short while, and he invited me to participate in a collaboration with the laboratory on nuclear materials, and that involves trying to develop new nuclear fuel materials, as well as understanding their thermodynamics, trying to understand what their fate is in aqueous fluids, issues of that sort.
So let's talk about the nuclear materials a little bit. For those of you who don't know, typically in a nuclear reactor, which is what we're talking about here, they're going to have the uranium. It's going to be a uranium fuel. Talk a little bit about the kinds of things that would be in there. What sort of form would the uranium fuel be in? What isotopes there would be and so forth like that.
So the uranium fuel typically is a uranium oxide. It's uranium-238, but it's typically enriched with uranium-245. And it is usually made into what we call a core, nuclear core, which has rods which separate the actual nuclear fuel rods themselves that control the power delivery, if you will, of the nuclear core.
Now, it's uranium-235,
right.
which is the fissile material. And the interesting thing about this is, even though the fuel can last a good long time and generate a lot of power, so in other words, they don't have to shovel in coal every day or something like that, sooner or later, the nuclear fuel gets to the point where it's considered to be spent. And is that the beginning of sort of the problem that we have associated with this kind of power source?
That's correct, because once this fuel is spent, you have to have a means to either sequester the fuel or to store the fuel. And presently, there aren't any long-term storage facilities available, or at least not in use.
As a matter of fact, in the United States, if I'm not mistaken, all spent nuclear fuel is stored on-site at the nuclear reactor still. Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
And so one of the issues has been, okay, we're going to try to find a place to take the uranium-238, reprocess it conceivably so that they can get material back out, and then take all of the things that weren't uranium that have now been created. So, I mean, this isn't about just uranium. Talk about the other kinds of things that are in there after this has been undergoing fission for a while.
So after the fission processes, there are isotopes and byproducts of the actual reactions, such as cesium and rubidium and so on. And these are radioactive in themselves. They have half-lives. And so once you look at all these different elements that you have within the spent material, you have a range, really, of the radioactive material.
And so now you've got to somehow store it. And when you store it, obviously, there's environmental implications. We all know that that's true. And one of the things they're worried about is that it can contact groundwater or something like that. So talk about how that plays into the kinds of studies they've asked you to participate in.
So there is one direct example of what can happen if there is a failure sort of incident, and that's at the Fukushima Daiichi plant in Japan. When the tsunami hit the particular plant, it of course was severely damaged, and there was a core meltdown, not complete but partial meltdown that occurred. There was a great deal of heat generated, and there were casings that contained spent fuel surrounding the core facility itself.
And so they came in contact now with seawater, and they're hot. And so they're worried about what happens to this material. So the uranium oxide now comes into contact with hot salt water, which means that you have the presence of other kinds of things involved there. And so talk about what kind of an experiment in a broad sense that means you're going to try to do. What kind of a system are you going to try to study then?
Well, that's really, that part of the science is not well known. And that's what we're attempting to do here at Missouri State through our studies. And the way we do this is using what's called a diamond anvil cell to try and create an environment that replicates that to a considerable extent. And the diamond anvil cell is very simple. It's just two opposing diamonds. They're gem quality type diamonds with the ends, sharp ends chopped off. And you put them in a little press, and you can squeeze those diamonds together against a gasket, and you can create tremendous pressure. In our case, we're not interested in tremendous pressure. We want basically a little bit above nominal pressure, which we can control using this instrument. We trap an aqueous sample, and then we can study it using either, say, Raman spectroscopy, which we have in our lab, or we can study it using X-rays as synchrotron devices, which are ring storage rings that accelerate electrons in a circular fashion and create intense X-rays.
So let's walk ourselves through this. You take some uranium oxide. What, you grind it up and mix it with salt water?
What we do is we take the uranium oxide and then we basically dissolve the uranium oxide through a chemical process, fairly intensive chemical process, in an aqueous fluid.
And so the kinds of things it's going to react with, aqueous fluid, that means sodium chloride. What kinds of things are you interested in?
Right, so first we get it into an aqueous fluid, and then we actually add sodium chloride or lithium chloride to this to introduce chlorine into the uranium oxide, dissolved uranium oxide.
So when it becomes the chlorine that's the most important thing in this process?
That's the first species that we're looking at in terms of this aqueous environment. And that's, again, because in many instances it is chlorine that's involved in these fluids.
Now, if you just put at relatively normal temperatures and pressures, like in a glass of water, and you mixed and made it salt water and put the uranium oxide in, would much really happen?
In fact, we've done those experiments, and we find that that there is some chlorine association those conditions.
And so that means what? The uranium is no longer by itself. What does it form? Some sort of a molecule or a complex with the chlorine?
Correct. This is really a molecular entity. It's called an aqueous complex. And these aqueous complexes are important in terms of transport of elements in aqueous environments.
Okay, so that's an important consideration. When you say transport, what do you mean? That means that somehow the uranium ends up being able to travel better in the water or get to places it wouldn't otherwise get? How does that work?
Correct. If the uranium is bound by a species to a considerable extent, it has less chance of to react, for example, with the surface, to be trapped by the surface, or potentially to precipitate out.
And so, therefore, it stays in solution, as it were, and becomes more problematic.
Exactly.
Now, I can understand in the Fukushima system, that means that the seawater and the surrounding ocean has uranium in it now. Is that
mm-hmm.
correct?
Right.
And so they're presumably tracking that with tracers of all kinds and have been for years.
Exactly.
And so you're trying to look at the actual science of it.
Yes.
So when you do this, you take the uranium, you dissolve it in this aqueous solution, you inject the chlorine in some way, shape, or form. And so now you put it into this diamond anvil cell, you put it in a synchrotron, and X-rays interact with it. Now, what can these X-rays tell you?
So what these X-rays can do is they can tell us what the local structure is, really the molecular structures of these aqueous complexes.
And when they study that, did you get any kind of a time dependence there, or is it just that this is in a dynamic equilibrium and you're studying what's sitting there, so to speak?
Well, it's pretty interesting. We get both, actually. You always get something that you don't necessarily anticipate. One thing that you look for is equilibrium, thermodynamic equilibrium conditions. Is for example, this aqueous complex stable after a considerable amount of time? And what we find is, in this particular instance, under synchrotron X-ray radiation environment, this fluid is not really stable, and that's because of something called radiolysis.
So you're actually having the x-rays cause problems too?
Right, exactly.
Well, that's always frustrating.
But it's also interesting as well because we anticipate that, for example, if you have the spent fuel in a storage facility and, say, in a canister where the fuel is hot and so on, so it is actually emitting radiation, that radiation will most likely produce conditions quite similar to this.
Oh, now that's interesting. So let's talk a little bit about that. When you have a radioactive element and it's emitting radiation, the kinds of radiation it's going to emit would conceivably be alphas, although that would not be obvious in this case. There'd be a lot of beta mm-hmm. radiation, and in beta radiation, there's almost always subsequent gamma radiation. Mm-hmm. And so are you thinking that the gammas can cause radiolysis similar to the X-ray radiolysis that would occur?
Correct. It's predominantly going to be the gammas that'll create most likely the most similar types of radiolytic reactions.
Is that leading you down a path to where you're going to try to actually do in situ irradiation with gammas to try to study this dynamic behavior?
We could potentially do that, yes. But of course, then it's going to be an experiment where we have a controlled environment in terms of gamma radiation delivery.
And it'd be a much more difficult experiment to do. So now these x-rays come back and you've got this data, and now you have to tease out from the data sort of what's going on. So give us an example. You've teased out from some of your early data that the uranium is what? Sitting there in a complex with one chlorine, or what do you got
so
going on?
So what we
here?
Found so far is that when we take it up to temperature, up to say about 300 degrees and so on and so forth.
That would be Celsius.
Degrees Celsius. There are more and more chlorines that begin to attach to the UO2. It's really a uranyl species. But then as you go to higher temperatures, then you start to see actually precipitation of the uranium in terms of, we're not quite sure yet, but perhaps UO2.
Okay. You said when you go to higher temperatures that
yes,
happens?
Right.
Does that mean it would be better to store it at higher temperatures?
Potentially. And so actually this may bode well because some projections show that temperatures may be as high as 500 degrees in canisters potentially when you store the fuel. And so if you have these kinds of reactions going on in case groundwater starts to filter in and so on, that you may have a lot of precipitating type of events happen.
No, I mean, the interesting thing about that is you don't want to compromise containers. And so how will you study, or do you have any plans to study, or have you ever thought about, okay, so now we have a uranyl interaction with chlorine, and now it's going to come into the contact with what would presumably be a stainless steel wall of a canister. Are you thinking about ways to do those kinds of experiments too?
Yes, I've thought about this. Of course, this is much longer range study, and this would involve funding or writing up grant proposals.
Because you've done stuff like that before, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
The interaction of nanoparticles and other kinds of things with stainless steel. I think you've done some stuff like that before.
Right, exactly. Yeah, but now we would want to not use just iron oxide type nanoparticles, but actual, say, short, small coupons of steel.
Right. Okay, fair enough. That makes sense. An experiment like this, talk about the time scale of what you're involved in right now and what kinds of resources the project has brought to bear for Missouri State University.
So this project right now is funding students, graduate students. So far it's funded two graduate students in our program. One of them was Duash Dakal, who has graduated and is now at the University of Washington in the Material Science Engineering Department, obtaining his PhD degree. And the second student is Nadim Akram, who's currently one of our graduate students in the program.
And the project's going to last for how long, at least the initial stages?
The initial stages will last through next year, I think about midway.
That makes it a three-year project to start with?
Right.
And so Los Alamos and you have developed this relationship to now where you're vetted and they can send money through projects like this. Has that been interesting working with that? I mean, what kinds of issues have you had to learn to deal with by working with a DOE lab like that?
Well, this is not proprietary work, but the interesting part really has stemmed from the way that Los Alamos works. So that's a little bit different than, say, Argonne National Laboratory scientists that I work with in that facility. Their Los Alamos laboratory personnel are a little bit more restricted.
Is it fair to say that there's a lot of vetting done for all the materials and transport and things like that?
Yes. Yeah. There has to be great care and transport of these materials, obviously. When we transport anything that has to do with containment, for example, of the uranium-based samples, it all has to be shipped under very controlled conditions.
Right. Well, that's given you some new expertise and some things to do. So you see yourself working on this for quite a while still? Is that look right?
I would like to work on it for some time in the future, yes.
Right. Well, it sounds great, and it sounds very interesting. Do you see that Yucca Mountain, from the things you've heard, is there really a move afoot? Is Los Alamos interested, from what you've heard so far, at actually trying to exploit this down the road to try to actually get something done with the uranium waste products in the United States? Is that part of their overall scope, do you think?
Well, one of their big thrusts actually are new nuclear fuels. The spent fuel is also a portion of their overall projects. I think one of the more interesting things is to try and develop basically uranium-based compounds that potentially are more stable than uranium oxide, especially under accident-tolerant conditions.
Right. Okay. Sounds great. Bob, thanks so much for stopping by and talking to us today.
You're welcome.
And this is Dave Cornelson for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.